What's up, y'all? My name is Desmond. I'm here on the line as a UAW 4811 member on day one of UCLA's historic stand-up strike. We've been out here since 8 in the morning, the same exact location that the university and these far-right mobs attacked the peaceful Gaza Solidarity encampment, which was filled with workers, students, and community members who were out here protesting for a free Palestine, saying that the university must divest from apartheid, genocide, and occupation. And so, like I said, I'm here as a UAW 4811 member telling the university that we're not going to stand for their repression. We're not going to stand for them saying that we can't stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people and with the Palestinian movement. We're here to say free Palestine. We're here to shut down the operations of the university for as long as we need be.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of West Bank Robbery. We got a full stack for you today. We got Amr, we've got AP, and we've got me, Bassem, one of your hosts. Say hello, Amr.
Hey, how's it going, folks?
All right. Everybody tell Amr how you're doing. Great. Wow, we love to hear it, guys. I'm sorry that happened. Whatever. we got a pretty stacked show for you today, and not because of any sort of pre-planning we've done, but because the world has been pretty stacked up lately. There's a little country called Palestine, okay? And it's been making the news a lot lately. Doing a lot better. Everybody counted it out, but goddamn if it's not in the news. So you were sending me this thing, this All Eyes on Rafah.
Well, it's an AI-generated I don't know what you call it, a meme or a picture or a poster of some kind. It like says All Eyes on Rafah spelled in tents. There's mountains there for some reason. As far as I'm aware, Gaza doesn't have any mountains, at least not like snow-capped mountains. And this is like an Instagram template that like has become really popular over the last however many hours. Full admission, I shared it initially. So I had reservations. Mm-hmm. I was a bit like, ugh about it. And then I shared it because I was like, okay, I guess if everyone else is doing it, I might as well do it. And then I deleted it because I realized that that's a stupid thing to think. Like, that's a stupid process to think of. And the critiques I saw of it are actually, like, to me, make a lot of sense. In that, A, it's an AI-generated image. It looks like shit, first of all. And there's no shortage of real photos sent to us from brave journalists in Gaza mm-hmm. right now, like actually taking photos of the damage and destruction. B, it's very like, you know, it admits political impotence. It's sort of tacit admission that like all eyes on Rafah. Okay, well, all eyes have been on Gaza for the past 8 months. Eyes on things don't really affect political change. Like this is the whole like witness, you have to witness this thing. It's like, no, genocides aren't to be witnessed. They're there to be stopped. Like, you're supposed to like stop them, not just fucking witness them. And thirdly, and this is where my personal biggest critique is, I think the reason this thing got popular, and I think it's shocked me how popular it is, as in like everyone from like Chelsea football players that I follow to like like Fran Kirby, Chelsea women's footballer, shared this, as well as like my annoying coworker whose feed is just populated with like him in bars and clubs and whatnot, getting drunk with his group of friends, shared this as well. Really? First thing he's ever shared about Palestine, by the way. Neither here nor there. Which is, you know, on the one hand, you can like see it as like a victory in that like enough people have like switched on, if you will. But my concern about it is All Eyes on Rafah is such an inoffensive phrase. It's so devoid of any political will. I don't think it's deliberate, at least, but I do think it limits the political horizon insofar as the reason it's so popular and everyone's sharing it is that it's All Eyes on Rafah. It's not something like from the river to the sea or free Palestine.
So it's an American drawn boundary.
You don't have to recognize Palestinian sovereignty about, like, if you share it, you still don't have to recognize Palestinian sovereignty as such. You just have to be like,
I just checked Facebook and a bunch of stories have the same photo, actually. But no, that makes sense. Like, because it is a U.S. drawn, like, red line. supposedly, even if it's not, you know, that is something that the U.S. decided was just completely, like, off limits. It's like, Gaza City, fuck it. Whatever. That's where war happened. Yeah.
Yeah. Khan Yunis. Yeah, it's whatever. But, like, even like, I mean, first of all, like, we can all agree that, like, there's no actual red line. It's all fucking rhetoric. Like, they're already in Rafah, and the U.S. is like, well, no, it's not actually defensive or whatever. But, like, yeah, like, it's, this just subsumes any political project into, like, look, this is happening and it's bad. And, like, obviously, yeah, it's happening and it's bad. But you could see the reason people like my coworker or Chelsea footballers are sharing this is because it explicitly doesn't name the perpetrator, doesn't say who's doing this. It's just all eyes on Rafah. Okay, great. And B, it doesn't name, like, the Palestinian cause. It doesn't really say, you know, this is why Palestinians deserve sovereignty, for example, or a national liberation, if you will. I don't know, it just pissed me off a lot. And, like, obviously, I'm pissed off because I'm pissed off at myself, too, for having fallen into that trap, if you will, and sharing it and everything. And obviously, again, also social media doesn't really matter, but, like,
I think it matters. You know, I go back and forth on this, but, like,
are you on that matter side of it now?
I think so. At the very least, because Palestinians are winning social media. Like, Palestinians adopted, like, internet communication and, like, I don't know, mimetic warfare or what have you, like, earlier than the Israelis and got a lot better at it and are having a lot more traction there.
Yeah, but what does winning mean in that context? Like, yeah, sure, like, they're winning in the sense that they have bigger audiences and then more access to, like, audiences in the West or whatever. But, like, how does that translate to affecting political change and, like, you know, really change?
It definitely, I think, alters people's ideologies in some way. You know, like, it's nothing without structure to funnel it. But I feel like, you know, there's a lot of people out there in bumfuck middle America who would be like, you know what? If Mr. Qasem came up to me and said, are you willing to fight for Palestine? I'd do it, you know, but there's no structure to capture those people, you know?
Yeah, that makes sense. That's fair.
I don't know. Like, it's not, it definitely can't be the end of it, but, like, it does feel valuable. I don't know why. If anything, just for the fundraising aspects of it, you know, I think that's been pretty successful, but America's not really governed by people or the West or anything, you know? So it doesn't matter what they think.
I don't know. That's kind of the part that weirds me out is the fundraising. It really feels like watching TikTok now. Every other ad is a fundraising ad for aid for Gaza. And I don't know, it just gives me like seriously like Haiti earthquake vibes. Like it feels like now the wolves are out and they see, okay, now we can make money on both ends. We can start fucking collecting aspect as well. And that feels...
No, I don't think so. Because nobody's collecting from the charity aspect. There's, like, I don't know, Islamic Relief or something like that, but, like, I don't know. From what I've seen, a lot of the TikTok stuff is TikTok, the tween stuff. You know, it's just kind of putting cash in people's pockets, I think. Really, there's no, like, it's not going to the Clinton Foundation or
save the children.
Like that. It's obviously not mobile anti-aircraft systems, but it does help, you know? Like, food is kind of there. And it does cost money. I don't know. It's not good. But it's not good that they got to be fundraising for shit. But, like, it's good. And, you know, get some people out of Gaza. Like, serious
health conditions. It feels like kind of a frenzy right now. And, I mean, obviously there's the real need that's provoking that. But it also feels like there is... people see the money now. It kind of seconds me a little bit.
I don't know. I like it. I like that you can be a grifter for Palestine. I don't really care, you know, but it's cool that, like, you can be a grifter for Palestine. Normally that would, you know, 20, 30 years ago, that would resign you to a life of poverty and screaming on a street corner. But now that you can make Palestine like a, you know, a brand-friendly thing, it's not good to, you know, profit off of suffering or whatever. But, like, I think it does show that there's, like, a shift, at least. Whether that matters is a different, you know, that's a different discussion, but...
That's where I'm stuck. Like, I'm struggling to see how to, like, translate that into something substantial, something with substance, something effective on a political level.
Yeah, that's the, you know, I guess that's like the big question, you know, what is to be done or whatever. You know, if there was like a party or something that was capable of capturing all these people, very useful.
If there was a group of like well-motivated and ideologically, you know, good, capital G good, mid-ranking officers in certain NATO armies, that would be interesting. That'd be nice. Like, you know,
that might be America's my
Nasser, if you will.
That might be my most strongly held colonel. Somewhere out there, there's a group of mid-level officers doing their best. You know, like, I really believe in them. The hidden, you know, the occluded officer, she's waiting to come out. You know.
That's the thing. I don't think the problem is like NATO armies are so like depoliticized. Like, there's, because they get so much funding, as long as they get their money, everyone shut the fuck up. Like, they need a proper, like, you know, defeat to like radicalize mid-ranking officers. Like, I'm genuinely, because like Afghanistan wasn't that. It was a defeat, but it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't Nasser trapped in the Fallujah pocket in 48.
Yeah, they didn't lose Sana'i, or like they didn't lose Florida to Afghanistan or anything.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. We America needs to have like its back broken somewhere, like, you know, some fucking arm. Like, if Xi Jinping launches an invasion and takes over like the Western seaboard, then we'll have some interesting officers, some interesting ideas.
To be honest, Palestine's basically an American territory, so it might have a similar impact. You know, if they get driven out of
Gaza. Actually, you're kind of, I wouldn't be surprised. Like, if I heard or read somewhere that, like, the reason certain American nationalists love Israel so much is that it's kind of gauche to be an American nationalist. I mean, not anymore post-Trump, but, like, for a long time it was considered, like, a bit too gauche to be an American nationalist. But Israel is the ultimate American nationalist dream. So you could be a Zionist and through that express your American nationalism as support for Israel, which is like the platonic ideal of America.
Yeah, they're doing the stuff that it's still not okay to really say you want to do or do here, you know. Killing all the Muslims, building a bunch of walls, torturing people for fun, legal murder.
Sex trafficking, pedophilia.
Yeah. And, you know, if it were legal here, then what would it, you know. They're not going to, like, I guess that would just mean pedophiles can fly visa-free back and forth. But I don't know, it seems like they have a good enough time there.
Yeah, well, I mean, the common refrain was what? That Israel is America's unsinkable aircraft carrier? Well, it's also like the unsinkable Jeffrey Epstein.
Little St. James. It's a friendly Little St. James. It'll be an iron wall of Little St. James's against the Oriental hordes.
Very much like our, you know, our extended Wild West. Did either of you see this story?
I saw that. What's the deal there?
About the settlement in the Northern Galilee that has seceded from Israel, has closed its closed its gates and said that no IDF soldiers are allowed in or out. No one is allowed in or out, like Jonestown, I guess. And they said we are severed entire all ties with Israel. This is the same group that was saying they were going to secede a few weeks ago. Interesting to see this. That the Fredonia Republic, are they familiar with this? The Fredonia Republic. This
Star Wars? No.
No, this was
Is this the Waco thing?
No, this is not Waco. This is like Alamo. More era.
Racist Texas.
This is like pre Texas independence. This was kind of like the first shot at that. Was this group called the Fredonia Republic?
Well, that's the first step to becoming a US state.
Just like this what is now the Republic of the Galilee.
I say good. We should split Israel up to like every settlement should be its own country now. Like they should all decide to like secede into like it should be like the Holy Roman Empire, but like all settlements.
They should, well, that, you know, they're halfway there. You know, they're split up. They're allowed to fight each other and take each other's lands. But when it comes time to do a holy war,
I'm hoping that's for kind it. Of the whole anyway. State.
Actually, on this topic of the occluded officer, there was an occluded officer in the Israeli military, the Zionist occupation forces. Did you guys see this? Yair Netanyahu retweeted it, or re-zobwobbed, or whatever they got over there, whatever their social media is. You know what I'm talking about? There's this guy. He's in Gaza. He's like, we will overthrow this fucking government. There are 100,000 reservists ready to pick up arms at any moment if you dare take one step back. I want to live here. Look at this fucked up house I'm in. I'm going to live here now. This is my home. We all died and shit for something, and it's to live here. Netanyahu, this is for you.
Yeah, he says something like, if you order us to retreat or if refuse to invade Lebanon...
Is this like a dumb version of like the Stalin, like, not one inch back thing, but like, first it's tragedy, now
it's worse. It is way dumber. If Stalin had a video camera back in the day, holy shit, though. That would be incredible. Mamma mia.
Thinking more like Japanese army competing with itself to commit greater and greater atrocities.
Actually, yeah, it would be like that. Yeah, it would be like the IGA and the IJN fucking competing over who can take Nanking first or whatever.
Okay, here, I've got the quote for you. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, this video is for you. So any listeners who are not Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, go do something else. We reservist soldiers do not intend to hand the keys over to any Palestinian authority. We do not intend to give the keys to Gaza to any entity, Hamas, Fatah, or any Arab entity. Reservist soldiers are behind you, and we want to win. Think really well who you leave the keys to after this. We want victory. Our brothers did not die for nothing. We weren't raped for nothing. We were not slaughtered in their and were not slaughtered in their beds for nothing. And he kind of just keeps going. He wants Gaza, I think, and to end the world, I think. He wants a new front, at the very least, I think.
Well, I mean, there's still 80,000 settlers who haven't returned to like the northern, they're like the wherever they're from in the north because of Hezbollah. So like,
it's like 200,000. Like, I think maybe that might be including the other, like around Gaza and stuff. But yeah, sorry, continue.
Yes, I don't know. I think I read 80,000, however a number, like several tens of thousands at the very least. And they're like, at the end of the day, yeah, I mean, you still, if you're a country, if you're a serious country, you have to prove to your people that you can protect them. And if you have like hundreds of thousands of people who can't move back home, yeah, I mean, the only thing you have to do is open another front. But they can't do that because they know they're going to fucking lose. Except I don't even know if they know that. I feel like they're run, like, it's completely run by stupid people now who actually think they're going to win.
Yeah, I think the biggest fear is probably, like, if the liberals don't let us take the gloves off, Hezbollah is going to beat us. We got to make sure that the liberals are going to let us take our gloves off in Lebanon.
I wonder if Israel has, like, a Sylvester Stallone who could do, like, a Rambo 3 where he's like, are they going to let us win this time?
Oh, my God. They don't make enough movies over there. They all suck. They don't have budgets. Like, what the fuck? What a shitty state. They should have 10,000 of these movies where there's a guy doing like Krav Maga katas against like 1,000 Hezbollah guys, Hezbollah Nicks, or whatever the fuck.
Have you guys watched that insufferable Israeli show where like they send spies to Tehran or something?
Homeland or Fauda?
Yeah, Fauda.
I've only watched the American version of Homeland every season.
Oh my God.
Yeah, the Israeli one is insane. Like, it's absolutely. First of all, it's shit. Like, objectively, I've seen the production quality is shit. It looks awful. I don't know how a country that gets like $300 billion a year in U.S. aid can't make one good fucking movie.
It's shocking, right?
And, like, I'm sorry, but you're this fucking startup nation. Get a few fucking studios in there and fucking make something.
Their biggest movies from about crying for killing people, like Sabra and Shatila. Like, it's like, come on. Look, even that was so long
like,
ago.
It's shit. Like, at least American Sniper. I mean, American Sniper was also shit, but like, at least the Americans have made enough movies about like, oh, we're sad for killing like 800 million Iraqis or Vietnamese or whatever. The Israeli ones, like, all the actors are like also shit. Like, they're not like Bradley Cooper, whatever else. At least he fucking, you know, did something all right with the American Sniper guy. Like, all the Israeli actors talk the same way. There's one affect. There's no emotions.
It's
insane.
It's really fucked. Like, I guess everybody decent moved to the U.S.
Yeah, we also have the genre of we're so badass and awesome for killing all these people. Look at how cool our guys that are killing them are. You would think Israel would come out a couple of those, right?
I've never seen one. There is a movie, I think it's called like Iron Rain or something. It came out in the mid 80s or like 82, I think. It's an American movie, and they couldn't get the budget to, or like the U.S. wouldn't let them film using American fighter jets because they, I think in the movie, like Air Force One gets taken over or shot down or something. So they went to like an IDF Air Force base, and they just shot using the planes that were on their way to bomb Lebanon and back. But yeah, I don't know why they can't make movies. Like, I don't know. Did you guys see that new, like, animation thing? Like, in English?
The gay, the guy who gets, like, thrown off a roof or whatever?
Yeah, yeah. The
that was unbelievable. That was so bad.
It's basically just, like, donate money to Gaza on TikTok. Also, I'm gay. It's Hamas says I can come to Gaza to be a hostage and help people.
No, it's worse. It's first of all, the gay guy is portrayed as like grotesquely large and also like classic, like dyed hair, etc., yeah. All of that. And he's like, you know, he speaks in the most like your classic like gay guy tone, like tone of voice, hello, like that sort of thing. Like, we're going to go to Gaza.
I'm sorry,
I'm just trying. I'm pretending to be the fucking video, okay? I'm not doing my slur myself, okay?
This
is the video was. And then, like the video. By the way, the animation is so bad. The quality is like just unbelievably grim.
Like freemium.
And then he goes to Gaza, and like he gets captured and thrown off a roof
immediately.
Which, by the way, like again,
by Yahya Sinwar, or by fucking by Sinwar. Sinwar fucking throws him off the roof. It's crazy.
Yeah, it's supposed to look like Sinwar. It doesn't look like Sinwar, but it's supposed to look like Sinwar. But like again, not to like again, I'm sure Israelis aren't able to distinguish this, but keeping in mind that, you know, throwing gays off a roof was a specifically ISIS thing, and whatever else you think about Assam or Hamas or whatever, Assam were the ones who defeated ISIS in Gaza when ISIS tried to do an ISIS, like, you know, branch in Gaza.
Almost immediately.
It was Assam who basically crushed them.
Immediately.
And which country has close ties to ISIS in Syria?
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah. Which country had ISIS fire off the worst rocket ever to assassinate a leader of a different group every fucking 3 weeks for a year before it was done? You know, like, goddamn.
Not to mention, like, you know, the collaboration between Israel and the Gulf states. And, like, specifically, Gulf states using Israeli tech to, like, monitor and track LGBTQ people in the Gulf. And I know this from
Pegasus?
Like, I've heard. Yeah, Pegasus, yeah. Using Pegasus to, like, track LGBTQ people I know in the Gulf.
That's crazy. It's a lot of investment.
They're trying to normalize relations, okay?
No, yeah, we can't normalize that. We can normalize with Israel. We cannot normalize the relationship between the genders. That is a step too far. The Zionist entity? Sure. Bill?
It's really cool that Israel's, like, culture war is, like, whether we can teach girls grade 5 math.
Oh, my God.
Like whatever else you think of America, like, for the most part, the idea of, like, secondary education has been a settled issue in most of the rest of the world. But not Israel, because that's, like, political parties are assembled around whether, you know, an 11-year-old girl can be taught, like, math or algebra or whatever.
Yeah, fucking brawls on the floor of the Knesset over the exact age, you know, a girl has to stop reading. It's like abortion in like the like mid-90s or something. They're like arguing over weeks and shit.
Just liberal democracy stuff. I don't know why you guys hate freedom.
The marketplace of ideas.
Yeah. I thought we had a little bit of news. My basement flooded this weekend. It was awful. I was about to go to bed. I had just been looking up stuff to insulate my windows so that I could heat my fish tanks more efficiently. And I opened my door. You guys can see it right here. 2 hours to sop it up. See, I've got dehumidifiers and shit running everywhere. That was hell. It was hell.
Do you know what caused it?
Just like an insane God-angering thunderstorm appeared. And flooded my entire backyard, and then all the leaves that were just in the backyard, like went, like pretty far away, kind of just flowed in. Shit, it was crazy. And I'm out there with like a broom, like sweet. I'm like the guy from like that YouTube video where he unclogs the drains. I'm doing that. There was like 2 trash bags worth of leaves. I had no idea what the fuck. Yeah, and so I freaked out. I dried it all, and then a friend of mine had an air mover, which is what you guys need. It's called an air mover. It points air at the ground. You guys ever flood anything. I go there. I'm driving through Langley, Virginia, okay? And I'm on a one-lane road, 3 a.m. on a Saturday night. Motherfucker starts tailgating me in a souped-up Mazda. Just a shitty fucking car. He's got floodlights installed on the roof.
Floodlights on his Mazda.
He's That's right up on my ass. It's like a 5-mile-an-hour street. Insane. He's flashing his floodlights behind me. He's like, he's right on my ass. I'm like brake checking him. I'm like, I could have shot the man. My God. You know, like it's a 25-mile-an-hour road. It's pouring rain. It's 3 a.m. There's 150-degree turns around like hills and shit. There's cliffs and ditches on either side. I don't know what's going on. I think he might have been drunk or like trying to fuck with me. He was trying to fuck with me, but I don't know what's going on. I managed to get away from him by fucking like braking hard into a turn and then going the other way. It was like fucking insane. Yeah,
people have been driving insane.
I was so annoyed too. Since COVID. I've just been cleaning up shit.
I mean, like, I don't know what's going on. And around here, another thing too is that they don't enforce the traffic laws anymore. So you can basically do whatever you want. About a ticket. The shoulder is now another lane.
I've been seeing some crazy shit. I think it's brain damage from COVID. And then also, specifically for this area, it's gotten a lot worse since the war started. I think people are like, you know that scene in Come and See where they're burning down the village? I think they're taking that energy to the roads. Because they're doing that at their desk job, and they take it out on the road. You know, they've got that like fucking horny-ass like murder rage going on.
Oh, no. I believe it. I believe it. People are fucking hyped up.
Gotten noticeably worse. I'm hyped up too. I'm a very chill driver. I don't know. You guys know me. I'm not a very hot-headed guy. If anything, I'm too calm and humble. But yeah. And AP, you went to a Go tournament, didn't you? Or you won?
Yeah, I did. I played at the Chicago Open. I played terribly. It was embarrassing. I won 2 out of my 6 games, and it was just depressing. I was studying so hard for it, and then I didn't sleep for probably, 2 weeks beforehand.
Yeah, you mentioned that to me. That seems like that's what I would do. You know, I get nervous before big stuff, and I don't sleep, but probably shouldn't do that.
That's what I was saying. I was sitting there the first day. I was sitting around there with my Go friends, and I'm telling them I'm so freaking nervous for this tournament. And they're like, maybe you should see a doctor about that. It doesn't seem healthy to be heart pounding over a board game.
No, that's ridiculous.
And I told them, you know, I was messaging psychiatrists that morning trying to get some pills. So don't.
It's completely normal to get your heart pounding over a board game. I do it every time. I always lose, which is unrelated, I think. No, board games.
I mean, my heart pounds over any competitive act. Like, if I'm preparing for a competitive activity, I start getting nervous like hours before. I'm like, you know, pacing and you know, like when I played intramural football, like the day of a game, my heart rate's already up. Like. The morning of a game that starts at 9.
Yeah, especially, I know. Especially since you were competing against the rich kid school to save the community center. That must have been a lot of pressure.
No, it was just different colleges in the same university, but...
No, you know, the classic Disney Channel.
It's the plot of the plot of an American high school movie.
Oh, we gotta save
We have to defeat the rich high school in sports.
Oh, right, yeah, like the Coach Carter theme.
Yeah,
movie.
To save a piece of infrastructure that should be public but isn't for some reason, that a guy can just buy.
Actually, they lose in Coach Carter, which I think makes Coach Carter is a great movie, is that they don't win. It's just, it's about, like, learning how to lose, which is, you know, I suppose it came out to the tail end of the Iraq War, so
that's
enough.
Good. I was really into the Gridiron Gang as a kid. I don't know why. We just
owned I don't know this one.
You guys know that one?
I'll be honest. I haven't watched a whole lot of sports movies. They look kind of boring. Though I definitely need to check out this Coach Carter movie, because learning how to lose, that's my where I need to learn. Oh my God, I was fucking tripping. I played this gentleman 3 times casually. 1, 3 times. and we go and play our rated game in the tournament. It was terrible.
Got cocky.
It was so. Right. That's what he was saying. He was like, "I'm going to pull out the secret Joseki I haven't been showing you for the last three games." Back in the.
That's another classic movie trope when, like, you're playing casually with someone and they miss all the darts or whatever. And then they're like, oh, guess what? Turns out I'm a right-handed, not left-handed. Got you. And then they just own you. It's like a classic movie trope.
That's what I've been doing. Anytime I've lost at anything, that's what I've been doing. I've been waiting until there's some serious money on the line.
It's actually a Go tradition. Back in the medieval era of Japan, the games would last several days. And every night, they would go back to their castle full of Go players and study a bunch of secret Josekis and come up with the secret games and pull it up on someone.
I think people are lying to you about the history of Go. I think it was invented in the 80s. I think people are just making this shit up. You told me that's where they invented black belts. You can float if you think hard enough. You can eat the rocks if you're good enough at the game.
Don't eat the rocks. The bowls were not finished with eating in mind, okay? They're toxic.
Okay, that's the 2 minutes of Go. I put a hard limit, okay? If anybody wants to play Go with AP, we'll have a Patreon tier for that. Okay, guys, let's get to a little thing I like to call World War I. I just finished a book called The Fall of the Ottomans by Eugene Rogan, my man, that guy from Dune. He's that guy from Dune, the Shai Hulud.
Wait, what?
Or the...
The Quiz Ass Haderach?
What's the guy? Who's the guy from Dune? The guy, the crazy Haderach. White boy? No, the crazy white boy guy.
That's like,
Arabic. Eugene Rogan's The Quiz Ass Haderach. Very good. You know, something that I learned in that book that really surprised me was that Gaza was the most heavily bombed place in World War I, or heavily shelled place in World War I, outside of the Western Front.
That is pretty insane.
I had no idea.
More than 15,000 shells, entire roughly, Eastern Front?
During the Second and Third Battle of Gaza. No, the single largest shell like location. There might have been more shells expended on the Eastern Front or something. I'm not sure, but Gaza was the single most heavily bombed.
Shells per kilometer squared or something.
Yeah, that sounds right.
It's like highest concentration.
The British had ships off the coast firing at it, and then a lot of other stuff.
Right. And this was because the Ottomans supposedly...
Yeah, because the British were...
Desperate for...
the Suez Canal.
They failed a bunch of times. They only got it through trickery. They went around and they took Beersheba.
Well, the Ottomans... Like, the British were always paranoid. The World War One is interesting because the British were actually genuinely paranoid that if the Ottoman Sultan, Abdul Hamid, I believe it was, or Abdul Majid, I think Abdul Hamid abdicated just before, but whichever the Sultan was at that time, they were afraid that if he genuinely declared himself caliph, like Khalifa, and called for jihad, they were afraid that all the Muslims at their colonies, and especially the Muslims in India, would follow jihad, like they would do jihad against the British. Which
they were really afraid.
Yeah, they were paranoid about that, but never actually happened.
That's like, a German kind of faith. Like, come on, the British had the power of the caliph.
Yeah,
they really did.
Yeah, the British genuinely had more faith in like the Ummah as like some sort of like actual concrete Muslim identity, that like actually like mobilizable Muslim identity than anyone else. Like even the Germans were like encouraging it, but like I don't think the Germans really believed it would do anything. The British thought it would, like, end their fucking empire. And, like, it just went down like a lead balloon. It was just, like, everyone was like, all right, sure, pal, you're the caliph if you say so, man.
Yeah, after, Kut al-Amara, where the British, like, lost and they were captured, it was, like, a big siege in Iraq, they were like, we can never lose again, or all the Muslims are going to go fucking, like, Power Rangers on us. They're going to, like, form up into a giant Muslim. And they're going to destroy us. It's going to end everything. We cannot lose a single thing. You know, do whatever you can. Just don't outrun your supply lines. Be very careful. If anything big happens, we're fucked. They're going to rise up. Which, you know, I guess in Cairo, they had not been treating people very nicely. Australian soldiers kept just burning down districts because they kept getting, like, chlamydia.
They were treating people in Cairo the way Australia today treats everyone in Bali.
Yeah, no, it makes sense.
But also, like the other big issue for the British was the Suez Canal. But like, I don't think the British, I don't think anyone really realized how badly the Ottomans, like how unprepared they were, and how completely like unmodernized their army was. It was completely fucked. Like, it was led by three useless fuck ups in the Young Turks. But more than that, it just, there was no cohesive Ottoman, you know, army beyond, like, okay, yes, Gallipoli was the only time, like, the Ottoman army actually was impressive, but everything in the Caucasus and the Eastern Front in Iraq was just a fucking
Iraq shit was, show. Like, empty. It was abandoned, more or less. Like, it didn't seem like they put any resources. I kind of thought Iraq was more important.
No, and they kept retreating up the rivers, just being chased down by the British.
Yeah, I do love some riverboat fighting, but yeah, no, it, like, the amount of like family politics involved, even in like small scale battles, like the amount of like finagling and like meeting a guy's cousin that was required to like organize a group of guys to go fight the British was shocking. And at the beginning of the book, I'm like, these fucking Bedouin are not helpful. They're not being helpful to anybody here. They are incredibly flaky, I think is a good word.
Well, Bedouin, like the Bedouin mode of warfare has always been raiding. Like, they're not supposed to be an army. They're an army you use for like harassing columns and cutting off supply lines, but not like, they're not there to face another army in the field. They've never been a reliable army.
And it fucked with them too, because like, they would take everything that wasn't nailed down when they won. Like, in Amman, I think, Jericho, I can't remember, one city in Jordan, the townsfolk joined up with the British and the Sharifian armies against the Ottomans, because they're like, the Bedouin will steal our roofs again. They stole our roofs last time. Yes. This is fucked.
I think it was Aqaba, but yes.
Yeah. That's it.
Yeah,
but by the end of it, I'm like, you know what? I respect it. They really show no prejudice in who they backstab or ask for a higher price. My dad did always say,
they're winning, they'll loot anything, but if they lose, as soon, yes, as a lot of people say, like there's an old hadith, and I don't know whether it's like, the veracity of it is very questionable. I don't tend to think it actually existed, but there's a hadith that sometimes people say, it's like Muhammad said, the Prophet Muhammad said, there's no man as untrustworthy as a Bedouin. Which, like, is hysterical, because after the Bedouin were pacified during the Islamic expansion, they became, like, the platonic ideal of what Arabs are supposed to be. Like, you know, the idea of, like, the romantic sort of, the guy with his horse in the desert and his clan, and that's it, and there's no... they're, like, the classic example of a hardy peoples that is Muslims who are like, you know, dandy fops in the court of the Abbasids or the Umayyads, who are like drinking wine all day and writing poetry or imagining themselves.
Yeah, they're like me. They've got a lot of potential, but you know, if you could just focus a little bit more, this would be incredible. You know, you'd be the Oppenheimer of this shit. You know, anytime you guys get your shit together, the world ends. You know, that's the cycle of civilizations over there. Whenever you guys figured it out and, you know, can stay focused, you know, get your assignments in on time, like, you can do scary things.
What you're saying is we need some Adderall for the...
Yes, absolutely. Maybe not. Well, yeah, what? How much worse could the region get? Give it the Bedouin Adderall. I think probably no.
There's not enough of them anymore. That's the problem.
They're
much like the Scottish Highlanders. They're a dying breed.
Another warrior people, the Scottish Highlanders.
They're the Bedouin. They're Bedouin. Well, they're all Turks, but, you know, the Highlanders are the original Turk.
Yeah, except instead of, like, horses, they got their skirt or whatever.
They don't ride that. No, I'm pretty sure they also had horses. They didn't, like, fly like Mary Poppins on their kilt.
They run around with their big, they have the big swords. That's what they're about.
They were much more of an infantry formation, but yeah.
Also dispossessed by the British.
Yeah, I think the Scottish Highlands and the Islands, and not that great for horses, for cavalry. It's kind of difficult terrain for fielding. or becoming an effective writer in the first place.
Look, I'm not going to learn about Scotland this episode. Yeah, guys, my Canadian geography is not very good. I can't overstate how bad my Canadian geography is. I've learned about the various provinces. I mostly know where Quebec is. Listeners might be shocked to learn that there is an English-speaking province to the right of Quebec called Newfoundland.
Well, calling what they speak English is a bit generous, but sure.
You have, like, my prejudice against Canadians is deep, but... Or, you know, it's shallow but wide, and yours is very deep and specific. Like, Baikal.
It's similar to how Europeans would, like, be okay with someone 2,000 miles away but hate someone from the next village over. We Canadians have that, especially because, like, you know, I'm from Toronto. And the classic sort of stereotype is that people from Toronto think they're the center of the world, which is true. We are the center of the world.
Yeah, you're in the same time zone.
The rest of Canada is...
I had no idea.
Well, and also we're as a cultured city with, you know, arts, music, etc.
Yeah,
whereas the rest of Canada is like a collection of villages and hovels, not fit to be a country, but, you know.
Aren't those that's the city where they, where Scott Pilgrim is from, right? It's kind of like a large, extremely large suburb.
I don't mean to disappoint you, but Scott Pilgrim is fictional. I hope you know.
I thought he was your prime minister.
Actually, I'm happy that you said Scott Pilgrim and not Drake, because like Drake is our eternal shame.
You mean Drizzy?
He's embarrassing. It's so fucking embarrassing, man.
He is kind of what I think of Canada. When I think of a Canadian city, I think of Drake. I imagine you walking down the street with your matchlock pistol in your back pocket, the police capturing you with, like, claymores, and maybe, like, a large cannon.
Speaking of Drake, I saw an amazing take on his beef with Kendrick. Listen to this. Lamar's most recent Drake diss is called, quote, "Not Like Us," and reached number one on Billboard Hot 100. It goes after Drake's cultural affiliations with the American South. Lamar taunts, quote,
"No, you're not a colleague, you're a fucking colonizer."
It's hard to hear that and not remember that Drake's mother is Jewish, and that this is the same invective used to undermine Jewish sense of belonging in Israel. Such racist habits of thought have become potent rhetorical weapons in the progressive arsenal.
I'm vibrating. I'm so excited. I love that. That I saw that. You know, I might have been a little down in the dumps or whatever. I don't remember anything before that moment. Once I read that, I was up, dude. It's like a shot of adrenaline. I love this. That's new. That's new, beautiful Zionist technology that we don't get that very often. It's always empty land, whatever. You know, kill the gays, but they're doing it, which is bad, but we'll do it, but whatever. You know, it's lazy most of the time, but that's brand new. That's beautiful. I really like that.
I mean, calling a black Jewish man a colonizer, progressive,
yeah,
more like
progressive left.
Regressive, am I right?
Colonizer, but you have to put all the, like, it's just C and then asterisk, 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 because it's a slur,
yes.
Technically.
Yes, that's very good. Very good.
Anti-Semitic slur.
And, like, why would you do that? Like, he's mostly in the news right now for being accused of pedophilia, from what I understand.
Yes.
No reason you had to do that. There was no reason they had to do that. Why would you do that? Great article, though. I'm glad they wrote it.
We need to associate him with Israel, is what we need to do. When I see someone accused of pedophilia, my first thought should be, how does this relate to Israel?
Yeah. And no, you cannot extradite them.
That's what I would think if I was
a part of. How do we get them somewhere they cannot
propagandists
be
is.
From?
I wonder if he'll get Alan Dershowitz to defend
him.
Oh,
hell yeah. Dershowitz on the track. That's good. That's good. There's something there. I just remind me to remember the Norman Finkelstein rap. You guys remember? You guys ever seen that? It's from like 2006. It's low-key. And he's, like, freestyling on the radio, and he has Norman Finkelstein there, and he's like, come on, Norm, you got this, Norm. Let's go, Norm. And Norm just goes, Norman Finkelstein.
Exclusive, Loki and Norman Finkelstein back to back.
Yeah.
My name is
Norman Finkelstein.
And I've been to
Palestine.
I went in a plane and a truck and a
limousine.
To the people of Gaza, don't let them
kill your dream.
They felt the
killing spree.
From Philly to the
Philippines.
I'm live on the
show and prove
in the
vocal booth.
Norman Finkelstein, you know I've got a flow that's
smooth.
My flow is deep.
It's rapid fire.
Here with my homie Lowkey and
Jody McIntyre.
There's more. Keep it locked. Keep it locked.
My lyrics are weapons of
mass destruction.
Smashing
assumptions.
I don't like
crocodile tears
or
Harry Tubman.
Arabic. You know that person that made us do this? Yes, Arabic. You don't like her. Because this time they went too
far, star.
It's Norman Finkelstein repping for
Gaza.
Yeah!
Yeah!
I have not seen that.
I have to check this out.
You can only find like a 120p video of it somewhere. It might have got taken off of YouTube in the Great Palestine Purge, but yeah. All right, guys. All right. Your sails are blowing. You're in the Gulf of Aden. Okay? You're ready. You've got all this spice. Your captain's taking the spice to get you across the narrow straits. The Gates of Despair, etc. I've brought to you guys an article from Phenomenal World, a magazine talking about underdevelopment, war, productivity, global technology, and the way that everything is related, that can somehow mention nothing about anything. It's really incredible. This is like college dumb. It's by Andrew Yamakawa Elrod. And the interview is with Gregory Brew and Caleb Demeroux on oil in the Red Sea. Gregory Brew and Caleb are both high-ranking professors. Gregory is a Yale University graduate, who now teaches at Georgetown, I believe. Sorry if I get this wrong, Jeffrey. I don't like you. Or Gregory. Yeah, Jeffrey. this is called Positioning Aden. Prior to October 2023, about a seventh of global maritime trade passed through the Gulf of Aden and the Red Sea to and from the Suez Canal. As a result of attacks by Houthi fighters on commercial ocean freight traveling through that area, that volume has fallen by more than half. Longer shipping routes around the Cape of Good Hope have increased freighting rates dramatically. The average price to ship a 40-foot container almost tripled from $1,400 to $4,000 between December and January. Today, that cost remains around $3,100. Longer freight routes have also increased world demand for oil, both to power container ships and increase stocks from shipping delays. As 2024 progressed, however, declining European purchases have offset this increase. As of May, Brent crude prices remain an annual average for 23 of $82 per barrel. Oil demand this year will increase by 1.2 million to 103 million oil 103 million barrels of oil per day, while OPEC is forecasting an increase of 2.2 to 104, about a 1-2% change. That sounds pretty crazy, right? Throughout this conversation, we're going to hear from two guys who are experts on the region, answering questions from a very dumb guy. How many times do you guys think this piece mentions Palestine?
Zero times.
Three.
Why would Palestine matter? That's, first of all, not a country, so international trade
control F Palestine
can't affect it whatsoever.
Doesn't bring up anything. Israel is mentioned. Gaza.
How about Control F Gaza?
Oh, one of three. Okay, we're in. Okay. A conversation with Caleb Demeroux and Jeffrey Brew. Let's begin at the regional level. What were the geopolitical tensions surrounding the Red Sea shipping routes prior to the Israeli assault on Gaza, and how has the Houthi response altered these dynamics? Caleb says, the region has seen rising instability for decades. Competition between Ethiopia and Egypt, as well as between Iran and Saudi Arabia, has transformed the African coast into a strategic battleground. Turkey's military base in Somalia, the Gulf States installations in Eritrea, along with a new $35 billion development in Egypt, and Ethiopia's planned naval base in Somaliland, are just some of the major indications that the traditional geopolitical divide between the Horn of Africa and the Middle East is eroded. That's the first part I take issue with, that there's a, you know, these are two very far-flung regions. I like that. The war in Gaza is intensifying these sources of instability. The Houthi attacks ought to be understood within this wider geopolitical context beyond the immediate war. The Houthis are advancing Iranian interests against those of the Egyptians and Saudis, who are direct stakeholders. This is really about power projection, showing the extent to which Iran can arm proxies with sophisticated and highly impressive sea drones and undermine Saudi and, by extension, American influence in the region.
This is something that bothers me a lot, is how much these people emphasize that the Houthis are armed by Iran. First of all, like, the Houthis, Ansarullah, I mean, you know, the official name is Ansarullah. I'm going to say Ansarullah.
I just call them Yemen.
For all intents and purposes. Yeah, well, that's really what I was trying to say, is, like, they're the Yemeni government now. I'm sorry, but they won. They control Sana'a. They control all the stuff that the Yemeni army used to have. Whatever, like, and, like, the Southern Transitional Council is a separate thing altogether, and, like, Aden and all of that. But, like, for all intents and purposes, Ansarullah are the government of Yemen. They are the country of Yemen. They have all the resources of Yemen, including arms manufacturing, and including the stuff that was in the stockpile of the Yemeni army. So, like, this idea of, like, these
guys
are
still...
They've
got all the shit from two armies. Two countries. They've got two countries' armies worth of shit there.
Yeah, so, I mean, this idea that they're, like, ragtag, like, still sandal-wearing, butt-chewing guys who, like, carry Kalashnikovs, like, I'm sorry, but they're an army now. They have all that stuff. They don't need, like, whatever Iran provides them with is, like, not exactly necessary to their survival. They already have everything they need. They get, maybe, I'm not saying they don't get anything from Iran, but, like, this shit is so annoying. Everyone says it. The FT says it. The New York Times say it. They all are, like, the Iran-backed Houthi rebels or whatever. They're not rebels anymore. They fucking won. The rebellion is over.
They're still often referred to as a militia.
Which is insane, because what kind... Like, at what point, like, would you say a militia has won? Like, one, they control the capital, they control almost all the populated areas. They have all the fucking, you know, currency and everything.
They fought a battle in space.
Yeah.
It's space.
They can project, you know, power onto
Well, you can't have it both ways. Either they project power across the fucking straits, which means they're like, you know, they've won the civil war, they're no longer just a militia, or they can't project power, which means they're like, you know, why should we care if they're a threat
you
or
talk
not?
About them like Al-Qaeda or something. Like that they could just spring up anywhere. It's just like a bunch of guys with machetes or something. Like, it's really crazy. Yemen is like, I don't even know if Palestine got the Yemen treatment of just ignoring it so fully. Like, the...
Well, it's just, like, it's frozen in time. Like, they just hasn't, like, they still treat it like it was, like, I don't know, 8-9 years ago.
So in recent years, the U.S. has had a limited role in Yemen. How recent? Much of the U.S. intelligence and logistical support to the Saudis and to the UAE happened prior to 2018. In 2021, the Houthis were targeting oil tankers and other strategic locations in both Saudi Arabia and the UAE with the aerial drones. It was the Saudis bearing the brunt of these attacks, losers. Even between Saudi Arabia and the UAE, there is no consensus on the future of Yemen. Even if North and South Yemen remain permanently separated, it would leave the Houthis with a continued presence on the Red Sea. For this reason, they do not really need to consolidate any more than they already have. The Saudis are already adjusting to this new reality, while the UAE is likely hoping to shift the balance a bit more. Meanwhile, the U.S. is increasingly sidelined. In short, status quo has already changed. Ultimately, the U.S. may have to adjust to a reality that includes a sovereign state governed by a proxy of Iran, despite potential hesitations to formally recognize it. KD, which is one of the assholes, says, "What do we make of increasing international disorder? On the one hand, and the relative stability in energy markets on the other. The fact that the global energy market has absorbed the Red Sea disruption may be linked to deteriorating regional stability. It's why China has not gotten more involved, even though their trade is being affected. Ultimately, China is less threatened by a disruption in the Red Sea than say, in the Strait of Hormuz."
Well, no, because China, Yemen has been specific in not targeting like China doesn't get targeted, Russia doesn't get targeted, India doesn't get, like, Yemen has been very specific on its criteria for what ships get targeted. Yeah. Like, this is bullshit. This is so stupid. Like, Yemen has been very explicit that it's targeting ships that help Israel or dock in Israeli ports or supply Israel. It's that fucking simple.
Yeah, Israelis don't own a shipping company in Beijing or whatever the fuck, you know?
In Beijing, yeah.
They've been very obvious. They put PowerPoints out about this every single week. Every ship they hit, they, like, write a little, you know, essay about it.
They point out the reasons for targeting those particular ships. And also, I'm sorry, but if I was a pilot on one of those shitty ships, I would love to hang out with a bunch of Yemenis and play cards and chew pot. That would look a good time. Damn it.
That's all I want. I want some cot, dude. That's...
Dude, did you see the... Yemen published also that any student in America that gets, like, expelled or whatever can get a free ride scholarship to, like, which, like, honestly, I would take it. Fuck it. I would hang out with my profs, chew some pot, you know, hang out, shoot the shit. That was awesome.
Yeah.
I feel like you could easily swing that into, even if you were some evil fuck, mm-hmm. you could easily swing that into a good career. Like, going forward.
Yeah, like show up at the think tank.
Like, no, you should go there with your business degree and teach them about derivatives. Teach them about, you know, subprime mortgages.
Options trading.
Yeah.
Weekly options trading and sports gambling. Oh, my God. God, we could really destroy Yemen with our financial knowledge.
Honestly, how much money did America spend trying to destroy Yemen and defeat Ansarullah? All they could have done was sent one JP Morgan exec to, like, explain to them, like, subprime mortgages and, like, fucking derivatives. And, like, the Yemen would have tanked immediately.
Send Pete Buttigieg,
like,
there, fucking... called a famine. They wouldn't even need to blockade anything. They just sent Pete, you know?
Get a microloan regime.
Yes.
They pulled that on India and absolutely destroyed the lower half of the economy.
You know what? I think we'd all like to see a resolution. So does the U.S. The U.S. like to see a resolution to the problem, but lacks the will to get involved. As the Red Sea isn't a theater of national security, isn't a theater of national security priority for the U.S. So because buy-in is low, the capacity of local actors like the Houthis to produce instability is arguably higher. No one wants to take full responsibility for addressing the problem. Katie says, energy is one of several commercial goods that travel across the Red Sea, the total worth of these goods being close to $1 trillion, blah, 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 blah. But to call it the energy purchase is one thing, but to call it a crisis that wasn't probably misses the mark. The Egypt, whose $8 billion bailout from the IMF did not even account for losing half of the source of its Suez revenues, this is certainly a crisis. To the extent that several Horn of Africa nations rely on wheat from Ukraine and Russia, interruptions in that supply certainly constitute a crisis. These economic crises in Northeast Africa are of great concern to the United States and its allies, given the concerns over terrorism and immigration. And this is all to say nothing of the inflationary effects of rising cost of container goods shipments. Certainly consumers in the West having to pay a little bit more for manufactured goods does not constitute a crisis per se, but the inflationary effects will still be felt in the long run. I like that he threw immigration in there.
God forbid people get their Amazon deliveries a couple of days later.
Immigration? Like, for the U.S.? There's not that many, like, I've been noticing a lot more Sudanese people walking around or anything. I know a couple, but, like, they haven't been showing up with their cousins, like, 35 of their cousins or anything.
I used to know Miss South Sudan. I was part of this community outreach group when I was a teenager. And anyways, one of the chicks there was Miss South Sudan.
You gotta be.
Absolutely, absolutely gorgeous woman.
I'm listening. Yeah. Hello. Keep going.
Tall too. Oh my God. Probably 6'3" or something. It's statuesque. Absolutely statuesque. Also very nice, very kind woman as well. But yeah. That's my only connection to Sudan.
That is also my only connection. Yeah, other than the, like, three Sudanese guys I know. Also know where it is. Unlike Quebec.
Do you think the average American knows where Sudan is?
No.
Like, if I pick a random yank off the street,
no.
like, I'm, sh- like, if...
No, what do you mean? Are you serious?
I don't know.
If you gave them a multiple choice question, is Sudan, what continent is Sudan on?
In Arabia.
I doubt you would probably, you would probably get maybe one quarter of people getting it right.
Jesus, so basically it's random.
You gave them multiple choice.
25% as if you would if you randomly picked
them. Total Rockets. Yeah, random.
Yes.
They know where America is, so like 94% chance. Like, they get an extra 6% chance off of that. They don't pick parts of America.
America fascinates me. It terrifies me. Like, the American public, I could do a PhD thesis on, like, and it's not a moral judgment. It's not like, I don't think, like, everyone else is better than American because of America. Like, there's part of it is deliberate, of course, like, you know, obfuscation and, like, deluge of information to, like, you know, make sure no one really knows what's going on when it comes to, like, all the fucking special ops and CENTCOM and all of that. But it still amazes me how much money goes into, like, the American empire in contrast to how much the average American knows about the world.
I feel like
where all the fucking stations
I have,
are.
Like, a mental disability. I'm, like, going to American public school. Like, my geography's bad. Probably got some of the best geography in America. And I went to a pretty good school. But it's bad. A European peasant knows where shit is more than I do.
You should have done like me and retrained your brain on Paradox strategy games until you knew the location of every country on the planet. And also every country.
I'm such a hipster freak. I'm always playing islands or like Mexico or something. I never play anything big. I'm never playing the HRE or the Ottomans because there's too much shit. I don't know.
You didn't play the United
like
States
Peru
of Central America.
Chile, that's always a hot spot for me in those map games, but it's my fault. It's my fault. I did win the first round of the fourth grade geography B when I picked Nigeria. I had like a Rain Man moment. I like closed my eyes, put my fingers to my temples, and I'm like, Nigeria. And then I was immediately eliminated in the first round of the second thing. But that was a pretty big moment for me. I can feel my endorphins rushing into my body just thinking about it.
It's crazy just how much money like goes in and out of the hands of like the average. It absolutely drives me insane. How much money is flowing in and out, and how you know, when you live here, you just, I mean, everything costs so much fucking money, but you're making so much money too. It's just, it's insane. The flow is it feels very much like being a cog in this
bigger
machine.
I like it. I like the money. It's good, you know? I'd like more of it. Anything.
Yeah, well, I like the how much money I bring in.
I don't.
It's the how much money I have to spend.
I don't like that either.
That's
I don't like
issue.
Any part of it. I wish I had just land that generated value. I wish I had peasants or something. Yeah, I'll protect them. I don't mind fighting a guy with my bros.
You could be like Lenin, and you could manage the peasants for your ailing mother. Old age.
You talking shit about Lenin?
No, he's my boy.
Okay. Let's move on. I'm upset now. So it just gets pretty good. This is when we start getting into talking around anything that's happening at all. So while the United States has successfully de-risked its energy supply, de-risking itself is not risk-free. In 2015, China invested around $250 million in a port in Pakistan called Gwadar.
I'm sorry, first of all, that's Gwadar. Such poor sentence construction. You've used risk to...
De-risking yourself is not risk-free.
These freaks don't have a fucking editor. Get an editor in there. Jesus Christ.
That's good. That's a sound blurb. If you just say that on the news for 5 seconds, that's pretty good. Look at that guy. They got a smart guy. He's got glasses. Went to Yale.
Think of how proud that guy was when he wrote that sentence. De-risking yourself is not risk.
I do believe this is a heavily edited audio interview, or like a roundtable discussion, perhaps. But it's published to a blog for a freak. This is good. This is the part where they just threaten people, which is weird. They're not CIA agents. They don't have power. They're think tank guys. But they threaten China with terrorism. China invested about $250 million in a port in Pakistan called Gwadar, with up to $1 billion planned in ancillary investments in infrastructure such as airports and desalination plants. The idea was that this port would provide a land bridge for the construction of an oil pipeline from China's Middle East export partners that would bypass the Strait of Malacca, a small strip of ocean cutting across the Indonesian archipelago. China was always fearful that the strait could be easily blockaded by rivals like India or the United States in the event of a military confrontation, leaving it effectively cut off from its energy supply. So Guadar represented the most important strategic tool for de-risking it. However, just last month, separatist rebels launched a coordinated attack on Guadar port, leaving some analysts wondering whether China's presence in Pakistan could be sustained. Without Guadar, China may become vulnerable again to energy blockade. Oh, God. That guy's erection just poked me. I felt it all the way over here. That was crazy. So again, de-risking is not risk-free. You guys were right. He's extremely fucking proud of this. He, like, totally is threatening China. Who are these analysts? Are they Chinese? Or is it another guy they know? Okay. Here, to what extent are the rivalries in the Red Sea region constrained by the larger economic and military ties with China, Europe, and the United States? Is the question. Great question. The answer is no. Here's a counterfactual exercise that is of interest. Let's imagine that the United States did not care about the Red Sea. Rather than attempt to flex its naval power in the region, it would look to revitalize its many bases in the Persian Gulf and continue to outsource Red Sea security to the Saudis. Clearly, this is not the case. Just as the Houthis used the war in Gaza as a springboard to justify a campaign with broader aims, the United States very early on has used Red Sea instability to assert itself in the region in a new way. Of course, it is doing so now through a multilateral coalition, compared to the unilateral campaigns of the early 2000s, when the U.S. launched its first military base in the Horn of Africa. This all means that policymakers in the United States clearly see some bigger issues at play behind the Houthis' unprecedented show of force, and the U.S. is not content to repeat the mistakes of the pre-9/11 era and leave the Red Sea to the Saudis and Egyptians. The same can be said for China, which now has a base in the Horn of Africa. China and Russia recently signed a deal with the Houthis for safe passage of their ships. I like that a lot.
It wasn't a signed deal. Yemen just said, we're not going to fucking target you. Like, what are they talking about?
I think Yemen was very clear about who and why they were targeting. They have very specific targets and for a very specific reason. And all you have to do is stop killing Palestinians. Retreat, and you will stop losing ships that are docking at your ports.
Not even permanently. You just have to take a break. You just got to stop for a minute.
Yeah, Jesus Christ.
They're very reasonable. Very reasonable people. There's not that much more here. It's mostly just like not mentioning Palestine in like increasingly roundabout ways. But I just wanted to hit you guys with some pretty good quotes from here. Oh, wait. We've got a good one about the Ottomans. The Red Sea remains the most important naval route connecting Europe and Asia. This makes it vital for naval mobility and logistics, especially since all the major powers now operate military bases in the region, which I think is everybody is just in Djibouti. It's just like a square kilometer with like a skyscraper that goes up into the sky and everybody gets like alternating floors.
Kind of like Delaware, but for militaries instead of corporations.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Everybody's just got a registered base there. It's all just like a P.O. box. In a conflict scenario, controlling or denying access to these waterways would entail a strategic objective to influence enemy military capabilities of adversaries and restrict the movement of naval forces. This is what helped the Ottomans stake out their own sphere of influence despite the ostensible naval superiority of the Portuguese in the 16th century. So given these strategic interests represented in this waterway, great power rivalries play a very significant role on both sides of the Red Sea.
Man, can you, like, this is awesome. Like, I wish I was one of those people that gets interviewed and gets paid, like, $300,000 a year to just say the dumbest, most inane things imaginable and like be treated like I'm some kind of god genius for saying things like, it's actually very risky to de-risk yourself from certain risk factors, you see.
You know, the Ottomans maintained control despite there being four Portuguese boats there with cannons that were better than them. You know? Isn't that crazy?
Also, the Ottomans didn't really control Yemen. Like, Yemen was famously resistant to Ottoman incursions. Like, it was only controlled in the same way that you can control, like it was controlled the same way a Paradox Grand Strategy player would control, like a color of land with your particular, like, you know, color. But it wasn't controlled, like, on the ground. Like, they didn't really have any power projection into the mountains of Yemen.
No, how could you? Really hot. and you're on the other side of them.
They're really high, and the Yemeni people were very good at, like, guerrilla war and cutting off Ottoman supply lines.
Huh. They should have done that. They could do that now. Get the Saudis out of there.
You're like the main character in Office Space when you walk into the meeting with the Bobs, the consultants that are trying to fire everyone, and you just say, you know, it's a really risky endeavor to try to de-risk this enterprise. And they just hire you on the spot.
God, can you imagine, like, any of us, we walk into a fucking think tank, we got the right pedigrees or whatever, we all of us know enough random trivia, you know, to make ourselves look like fucking geniuses in a crowd of these guys. Like, just, oh, do you know about Abdul Hamid? He was in charge of the Ottoman Empire, and he did something very similar to this Chase Bank merger that you're attempting, you know? Or, like, you know, Ottoman cannons, they were bigger, but the Europeans figured out how to make their cannons thinner.
Yeah, it's fucking insane, man. It's so stupid.
And then the article ends. They also go on about the Abraham Accords and stuff. The future of the world order has an immediate political salience this year with the U.S. election and the division within Congress over supplemental military spending for Ukraine and Israel. Not true. Only for Ukraine. Do you see U.S. domestic politics as a variable in the regional situation in the Red Sea? To a certain extent, yes. As we've seen with the procession of the Abraham Accords, there is a manner in which a Trump presidency would reshape the scope and manner of U.S. engagement in the Red Sea. However, just like it would have been hard to predict the Abraham Accords or Hamas's attacks on Israel, it would be impossible to predict precisely what these changes would look like, or even whether this will make the region more or less stable. That's pretty good.
We can't predict anything. Congratulations. Thank you, genius. Wonderful. Great, great analysis.
They're describing the Abraham Accords like it was like a surprise attack. You know, like Trump was like getting ready. They trained for 2 years. Trump's on a fucking paraglider, like taking a fucking Valentine from like Saudi to Israel or whatever. Like, Jesus. I think both a Trump and Biden administration would face a very difficult road ahead with regard to Yemen. Military strength cannot accomplish the U.S. goals against the Houthis, but a Trump administration would likely favor increased use of military force, potentially spreading the fight to include Iranian targets, as there is broad support for the idea that pressure on Iran will rein in the Houthis. So there's a risk of the conflict growing under a Trump presidency. The outlook for Biden isn't much better. The U.S. doesn't have effective means of leverage to compel the Houthis to change their actions. End of article.
Well, that's so funny because at that end right there, that's what our entire article should have been. The U.S. doesn't have any way to compel the Houthis to direct their behavior. Except actually just like listening to them and being like, okay, this is what you want. Okay, we'll stop sending fucking arms to Israel.
It's crazy. They can't even mention the thing that they have the power for. It's like insane. That's also the only definite statement in the article. I like went through it. Barry's. No definite statements. It's here's a counterfactual that might suck your dick. Or, you know, maybe perhaps this could influence events. And, you know, de-risking is not risk-free, maybe. Sometimes. It just ends with, but America is powerless.
Okay, yeah, there's this one weird trick to solve all your international shipping issues. And Biden just doesn't want you to
I'd like to reiterate my thing that if Biden declares war on Israel, I will...
Yeah, presidents hate this one weird trick.
I'm pretty good at canvassing. I'm pretty talkative. Voters like me. I'm plucky.
I enlist. I fucking drive down south and enlist.
Oh my god!
Like I want to be on boots on the ground in Tel Aviv. Absolutely. Like fucking put me in there.
Goddamn! I never even considered that. They'd have me in an instant. I will go D-Day on that shit. I will be the first one in the boat. I don't mind getting missed it. I don't even want to be in a jet. I want to be like be up in there. You know? I want to see that shit. Oh, that'd be so sick.
Parachute me into Tel Aviv.
Fire me in there. I'll land. I'll figure it out. I don't need a parachute. Just send me in there, Biden. Just let me come back home and get tax-free income for like the 3 months that I'm there or something. I don't even need that, but like that would be nice. I assume that's part of the deal, but yeah, I don't know. That article was pretty crazy. I've been thinking about it all week. I really enjoyed it.
So stupid. These people are so stupid.
I'm gonna keep de-risking. Fuck. De-risking is a risky.
Does anybody ever re-risk? Does anybody ever re-risk their energy supply? Has anybody ever done that? We're going to build a really shitty bridge that we got to go over. We're going to make our guys do jumps.
Re-risking is a risky, is a de-risking approach.
Also, I like how this entire article talks about energy supply and doesn't want to mention how much Saudi has America by the balls when it comes to, like, OPEC driving up oil prices. Like, Biden went to Riyadh to, like, grovel at the feet of bin Salman. Bin Salman was like, yeah, no, fuck off. We're going to keep oil prices high. I don't care about your re-election. Fuck you. Go fuck
yourself. That's what I like about the Bedouin. Completely no loyalty. I really appreciate it. I like that. I really like that. That's what I like. Like, Jordan, none of that. There's none of that energy amongst the Hashemite dogs, you know? Like, they'll do whatever. But the Saudis...
they like their money. They like they want OPEC money. Why, like, why the fuck should they help Biden with, like, lower gas prices? Fuck you. No, we want OPEC.
Yeah, but they won't even take, like, a 2% haircut. You know, Jordan will just do whatever. The Saudis are like, no, what do you mean? Are you going to pay me back?
A 2% haircut for your average Saudi prince means, like, 1 week less of Baccarat at Monaco. Which, like, you know... parts out to, like, you know, the all.
Do you know how to play Baccarat?
I don't know. I've seen it being played. I'm still not quite sure how to play it. But it's a big
thing. I think it's learning it for network.
The Saudi princes love to play it. Like, especially the older ones. They love Monaco. Play Baccarat Monaco.
And I don't know any good Saudi princes. All the Saudi princes I know are, like, stoners. Which is, like, two. But that's more than you would think, right? We didn't really hang out. We should have hung out more in high school. Why didn't my parents' anti-Saudi bias kept me away from hanging out with Saudi princes? I would have got some good startup capital. Maybe I'll hit them up.
Yes. Hey, you remember me? I was the guy that called you a pig back in high school. Smoked me out.
Yeah, I repeated the fact that you got cocaine shipped to you with diplomatic immunity, which is probably not true. Then I don't really think about it, but somebody told me that. And he's like, oh yeah, they just get cocaine mailed to their house because they have diplomatic immunity. I don't know if that's true.
I mean, it's not diplomatic immunity. It's just they're rich enough to get it. Like, I don't think it has anything to do with diplomatic immunity. It's just they're all, like, all of that, like, class of, like, diplomatic elites get it just because they're rich. They have the connections.
Yeah. It's also right next to Langley, so... they probably just drove by and popped it in the mailbox.
Yeah, also, Coke is a good one to get mailed to you because there's no... it's hard to detect by smell or whatever. You know, so...
I bet CIA cocaine is, like, the best. Like, I bet like, if your buddies at Langley are getting it to you straight from, like, a cartel, straight from Bogota, like...
yeah, that's where they cut it.
You're not fucking around.
Yeah,
you're
getting that's where they cut it, you know? That's where it starts. They gotta ship it from Langley all the way back to Miami, you know? They want to keep their eyes on the product.
How terrible would it be though, when you OD on the CIA cocaine? They cut it with fentanyl.
That's so true.
Every one of America's institutions is hollowed out now. They can't even keep the CIA cocaine clean.
I guess I'm assuming that, like, the CIA would be nice enough to give you the coke before it's cut if you're, like, a Saudi. Like, it's like we gotta grease.
Have any Saudi princes OD'd?
Their Gulf pals.
Anyone that's learning Russian?
Not that
I'm Saudi prince knows Russian.
I know. There have been, like, rumors of how some of them are, like, druggies.
How
and,
couldn't,
like,
they be?
True freaks, but no. I mean, I'm sure some of them have OD'd, yeah. But they probably buried that. They're like, oh no, it's just a heart attack or whatever.
Yeah. No, I just assumed they were old, fucking snorting lines and shit. You know, it never occurred to me that they weren't. I'm kind of orientalist towards the Saudis, to be quite honest. I have, like, an orientalist vision of the Saudis. Like, Palestinians, like, Syrians, Lebanese, normal guys. They're just like me and you, you know, regular guys. But the Saudis, I'm like a 1920s, like, silent film perception of them, which, you know, I don't know if I'm wrong.
I have strong feelings about the Saudis, but that's for another pod.
Yeah. Guys, I think that was a good episode of West Bank Robbery. You guys enjoy that?
Yeah, it was great.
I hope you, listener, enjoyed that.
I enjoyed myself.
AP, armor-piercing wine.
I polished off an entire bottle of wine with my name on it.
Anyo Palestine, whatever. Okay. Always pissing. You haven't pissed once, unless you've ran away very silently.
Always pissing. Always pissing the wine that I just...
Cool. Also, dear listeners, we are at episode 28. This will be our 28th episode. And a long, long, long time ago, we agreed that episode 30 would be the time we launched a Patreon. So keep on the lookout for that. But it's important that in this period of gearing up for the war of the wallets, that you tell your friends. So go tell a friend with your real human mouth. Or like 15, let's go with 5 people on the internet. 5 people on the internet, or you tell somebody with your real human mouth. Because that's the only way podcasts spread. Advertising doesn't work. Nobody trusts that shit. I know I don't click on random podcasts. It's like a fucking spam link.
Yes, if you see a link to West Bank Robbery.
Yeah, all right. Thank you for listening.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Everybody go check out Armor on his various Radio Warner appearances. Also, Das Kriminal, fantastic podcast. AP, say goodbye.
Goodbye. Free Palestine. Goodbye.
All right. Free Palestine. Fuck the police. That's a wrap.